Now, today's lesson is an introduction to the book of Ecclesiastes. And hopefully you've read it. If you haven't, it doesn't take long, it's 12 chapters. But if you have read it, you will very quickly recognize it's a very unusual book in the Bible. As I mentioned, some people wonder, I can't believe it's there. But I think it was in this group last week I mentioned that R.C. Sproul, who is probably in his 80s right now, a very, very fine theologian, says it was reading through the book of Ecclesiastes, he says it was instrumental in his coming to Christ, believe it or not. The famous author, Tom Wolfe, everybody know who Tom Wolfe is? He wrote Bonfire of the Vanities, among other novels. I don't really know much about his spiritual life, but Tom Wolfe says Ecclesiastes is the greatest single piece of writing I have ever known. And the wisdom expressed in it is the most lasting and profound. Now, before we proceed, I'd love to hear any thoughts that you might have on it. I mean, any just kind of initial reaction that you had after reading it. Any thoughts, any comments?
It is pretty interesting, you know, according to the richest guy that ever no long-term sustainable happiness as well, or whether knowledge.
Yeah, I've heard it said, and this was serious, is that if you took Solomon's wealth, and it's pretty certain that Solomon wrote the book, and I'll show you that in a minute. But he says if you take Solomon's wealth and you put it in today's terms, that he would make Bill Gates look poor. He had that much money. He had that much wealth.
It's a book that it's pretty modern too. It speaks to today's generation as much as anything I've read in the Bible, really.
I said the same thing yesterday, Steve. It was very contemporary. Believe it or not, it really speaks to man, modern man, I think, in very clear terms. And it's pretty timeless, really, in its truth. Anybody else?
It seems like today everybody's about trying to make things fair for everybody. And when I read about that, you're such, life's just not fair.
Life's just not That's a great, absolutely. Anybody else?
Are you going to talk about what it means to fear God?
I wasn't planning on talking about that today. Would you like to?
Well, that seems sort of one.
We're going to come back to that. That will be probably one of the last sessions. We're going to do that. We're going to spend four more sessions on this, and that's kind of where we'll end up, Jim.
You know, Richard, at first blush, it kind of seems like Solomon's lost his mind, and then you kind of ring out, wait a minute, this is starting to make sense. Once you kind of unpack what these words actually mean, I know you're going to go into that. Just read it and kind of come up, again, first watch. What happened to him?
Yeah. Well, you may or may not know, Solomon went through kind of a dark period in his life. He kind of lost his faith. He kind of drifted away from it because he married all these women that were, he would conquer a nation and he would marry somebody from that, he was trying to please everybody, so he had all these wives, and you see him really kind of drift away from the faith even though he returns. And what you see here, Charlie, and he kind of vacillates as he writes it, but what you see here is this is not a young man writing about his life. This is an old man looking back and reflecting on what he's seen and what he's experienced and what he's tried and what he's attempted to do with his life and his wealth. Anybody else? All right. Before we start, I'm going to turn the AC down. What do you think? All these hot bodies in here. All right, let's, let me make the comment that I started on a minute ago, that almost every Old Testament scholar, and I have a number of books written about the book of Ecclesiastes that I used as a resource, and every Old Testament scholar believes that the book of Ecclesiastes was clearly written by Solomon. He never identifies himself as Solomon. But look, everybody turn to the book of Ecclesiastes, and you'll look in the first verse, and it says, the words of the preacher, or the words of the teacher, the son of David, the king of Jerusalem. And if you look at David's lineage, and you look at the incredible wealth that he speaks of having, there's nobody else that it could be other than Solomon. And as I mentioned, he is writing about what he had learned in life. He's older, and he's kind of looking back and writing on what he's learned. And these are not the words of a man who's, basically these are the words of a man who's seen it all and tells us all that he had discovered on his search. And his search, you'll see, is a search for meaning. Warren Wiersbe, who is one of the authors of a really great commentary on this book, says, do you find yourself unsatisfied with things in your life? If so, you are in good company, because dissatisfaction is a part of the human condition. That's why God gave us the book of Ecclesiastes, to remind us that satisfaction in life is not an external issue that can be appeased by amassing more stuff or having certain life experiences. He says it's an internal condition of the heart. But he goes on to say, I believe the true satisfaction in this life is possible, but to only the extent of my personal relationship with God. And he says, this is the big idea that runs through the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, in order to really understand this book, there are some key words that you run across over and over again. And because of that, they must be significant. And so I want to look at some of the words. Now, the first word that I just want to look at is that word in the first verse. He says, the words of the preacher. Some say teacher. Does anybody have any additional words from a different translation? Well, it's the actual word. It's a Hebrew word, koheleth. Q-O-H-E-L-E-T-H. Koheleth, which means one who gathers, one who assembles, or one who collects. Ray Stedman, who's also written a book on the book of Ecclesiastes, says an accurate, maybe and a helpful English translation is the word searcher. You know, he's searching. And then I read an old sermon by Tim Keller, and he thinks the best term to use would be call him the philosophy professor. The philosophy professor. Because, you know, as you read through these 12 chapters in this book of the Bible, that you notice that this philosophy professor, this searcher, seems to hone in on certain ideas. And think about what some of those are. Again, if you're looking at the first chapter, look at verse 2. What is the, in the New American Standard, he says, vanity of vanities, says the philosophy professor. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does the NIV say?
Meaningless.
I mean, what a great way to start off a book. Meaningless. Everything's just meaningless. And the Hebrew word that's used there is the word hevel, H-E-V-E-L, and hevel is used 38 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. And Hevel means emptiness, futility, to be a vapor. In other words, the idea of whatever disappears quickly and leaves nothing behind and doesn't satisfy is Hevel, is meaningless. And Solomon, when he considers his wealth, all the pleasures he's experienced, all the works that he does, all the knowledge he gains, what does he conclude in chapter 2, verse 11? Somebody read it. Bob, how about reading Ecclesiastes 2:11?
Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun.
Though you see this mentioned often, meaninglessness, vanity, it's important to note that this is not his final conclusion, even though you, as you read it, you think this is what he believes about life. Comment?
Richard, I underlined a bunch of times under this, but I underlined the term under the sun.
That's what we're going to look at. That's the phrase we're going to look at next. Anybody else?
Richard, I think you could say that that was one of the things about Solomon is that God gave him wisdom, right? And I think that his realization of the meaninglessness of these external things is sort of emblematic.
Yeah, I think you need to we need to step back, and Jimmy's just brought up a good point, and understand the term under the sun, because I think it's key. Because I think what he's like a philosophy professor. He says, this is the way life is under the sun. And though he doesn't believe this necessarily, he's just kind of describing this is what you have to conclude with life under the sun. And under the sun, which by the way, is mentioned 29 times. And it defines kind of the outlook that he's trying to bring to the table and saying, basically, this is what life is like from a human perspective and not God's perspective. Or as Max Ander says, the basis of meaning of this phrase is man's perspective on life devoid of God. In other words, this is my perspective. If there is no God, this is what you have to conclude. Everything is meaningless. And I'm going to show you why in a minute. G. Campbell Morgan said this about this phrase, life under the sun. He said this man had been living through all these experiences under the sun, concerned with nothing above the sun, until there came a moment in which he had seen the whole of life, and there was something over the sun. It is only as a man takes account of that which is over the sun, as well as that which is under the sun, that things under the sun are seen in their true light. So, when you see that word, under the sun, really what Solomon is saying is, this is what I discerned, this is what I discovered about life. With the perspective that is completely devoid of God. It doesn't mean he doesn't believe in God. Because that's, as you read the conclusion, he does. And he will interject that. So it's kind of like, it's interesting, it's like he shares two perspectives. He says, this is what I discovered with life under the sun, that as you live this life, there is no God. This is what happens. And we're going to kind of go through that in just a few minutes. Anybody else?
Surely a secular worldview.
That's it. It's a secular worldview. And in fact, as Steve said earlier, this book is so contemporary, as you'll see. Now, go back, chapter 2, that Cobb just read, in verse 11, he says, the New American says, there was no profit under the sun. The NIV says, there was nothing gained under the sun. that comes from the Hebrew word yitron. And it's used 10 times. And it means when all is said and done, this is what's left over. You see Solomon say, with all the mystery and all the problems of life, what is the reason for living? Is there any profit? Is there really any gain? And so you begin to recognize that life under the sun is depressing. And you notice a sense of despair. Now, in a couple weeks, there's another term that's used 23 times in Ecclesiastes. And it's the word labor. The word work. And that's an important term. It's the Hebrew word amal, amal, amal. And you see it 23 times in Ecclesiastes. And it's a very unusual word. Wearsby says it means more than just getting out and going to work. It means to toil to the point of exhaustion and yet experience little or no fulfillment in your work. It's hard to believe that one Hebrew word could mean all that. But it carries with it the idea of grief and misery and weariness. And the final word that I want to just consider, and it's a crucial word, and we'll look at that next week and the week after. And it's the word, do you notice he says about it's good to enjoy, and then he'll say something? He uses that word a lot, joy and enjoy. And it's used at least 17 times. And the one thing you'll notice is that he is real big on enjoying your life. He says that 3 or 4 times. But there's a key. What you recognize is you see he says that. There's a key to really enjoying life. And that's in Ecclesiastes 2, 24 and 25. Donnie Patton, would you read those for us? Ecclesiastes 2, 24 and 25.
A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too, I see, is in the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment?
Well, apart from him, who can eat and find enjoyment? You know, when he talks about life under the sun, he talks about it being vanity and meaningless. And here he's talking about it, but he's interjected God back into the picture. Now, we're going to come back to this because I think this is an important point. But before we move on to something else, I wanted to know if you noticed, as I did, that so much of this book is a series of questions. Did you notice that? He'll always stop and ask a question. For instance, in the first chapter, in the third verse, you know, he's already railed about everything's meaningless and vanity. He says, what advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? He asks a question. Go to chapter 2, verse 2. I set up laughter. It is madness and a pleasure. What does it accomplish? In verse 12, he says, so I turn to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. For what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? And then in verse 15, then I said to myself, as in the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this is my vanity. So you see throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, the searcher, the philosophy professor, prevents us with the questions that philosophers have been asking throughout the ages. And for this reason, as Steve pointed out, it's a very contemporary book. For if you look closely, he asks some really penetrating questions. What is your life really all about? What are you trying to accomplish? You toil and you labor, and at the end of your life, what do you have to show for? I mean, ultimately, he wants to know, what difference does your life really make? as one commentator put it, if we're not asking these questions, we're not really living very thoughtfully. And what strikes me is that many times, as he considers life under the sun, you see real despair. You see, it's kind of like, why even be alive? Look at chapter 2. Go to chapter 2.
Richard, I can't help but think of your story about the mother telling the child that the stove's hot. And she has an
iron's hot, yeah.
He's offering us this about the life. And the question is, can we accept it or we have to live through it before we live?
Yeah, I think you're right,
David.
I think you're absolutely right. And it's, that's why it's, this is why Ecclesiastes is considered part of the wisdom literature of the Bible. All right, who's going to read for me? Ecclesiastes 2, 16 and 17. Greg Pyburn, you want to read for us?
Okay. For there is no enduring remembrance of the wise or fools, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How can the wise die just like fools? So I hated life, because what is done under the sun is grievous to me, for all is vanity and chasing after the wind.
What is he saying there? Particularly, take verse 16. What is he saying?
Yeah. Who you are.
Yeah, he says, I don't care. Yeah, you're going to be forgotten. You know, 20, 30, once you die, 20, 30, 40 years, you're going to be forgotten. He says, there's no way you can make it. I mean, he's talking about life under the sun. You got to remember that. That's the perspective. He says, there's no way you can make a difference in the world with your life. When it comes to human history, your life is insignificant. That's encouraging, isn't it? How many of you remember your grandparents? Everybody remember your, you remember your grandparents? How about your great-grandparents? Vaughn remembers his great-grandparents, but the rest of the world doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't mean that in an interview. I mean, I remember my great-grandmother. I was a little kid, and she was 90-something. But I bet there's hardly anybody alive today that even remembers who she was. The Solomon says, no one remembers you. And in 100 years, no one's going to remember any of us. And this is why he despondently says, everything is futility. It's like chasing after the wind. And so, guys, this is what he's asking. If life under the sun, remember, life devoid of God, if life under the sun is all there is, it means there is no God who put us here. There is no God who's sustaining the universe. There's no life after death. There's no eternity. And there's no meaning. And so it's not surprising that you see him in such great despair, almost even depressed. Now, this is written like Isaiah was written 2,800 years ago, so this was written, you know, the deal in the past. But fast forward to today. Now let me read to you someone who is modern and contemporary and what he has to say about this. This has nothing to do with Ecclesiastes. This is a guy by the name of Martin Seligman. I've quoted him before. He's written a number of best-selling books. I've got one at home that I've read some of. It's called Flourish. He is a psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania. And he is the man, and I quoted this 3 or 4 years ago at the Birmingham Country Club in one of my talks. He's the man that said that the baby boom generation suffers a 10 times greater rate of depression than their parents' generation. And then, I don't know if you remember, I was kind of taken back. These are his words. And then he is truly, this is something he has great expertise in. He says, we're the most depressed generation in the history of the world. And how he can come up with that, I have no idea. But he says, we are depressed for the same reason Solomon found life to be so depressing. Seligman suggests we no longer live as our ancestors, as our parents or their parents. He said, they, and I don't know, I have no idea about this guy's spiritual life. I don't appear to be a, come from a purely Christian point of view. In fact, Seligman is a Jewish name. But he says, we no longer live as our ancestors, who clearly lived, these are his words, for a cause much bigger than themselves. He said they lived first for God, and then for family, and then for country. He says that's not the way modern people live anymore. They're more secular, is the word he used. They live godless lives. They therefore merely live for their own pleasurable satisfaction. And Seligman believes this approach to life always leads to emptiness and despair. And this is Solomon's view as well as he considers life under the sun. Really quick, I'm going to give you a good modern example of this, of what Solomon is saying, I believe is absolutely correct. If you look at life under the sun, if you look at life devoid of God, that we're just basically a mass of chemicals living this life, you have no option but to conclude that life is meaningless. And there's a lot of examples, but one of the best ones you see, and I am a real fan of his movies. A lot of people don't find that hard, but of Woody Allen. And I don't know if you've ever watched any of his films. In my opinion, the best one is Crimes and Misdemeanors. And there's two stories that go along. The main story is about this wealthy doctor who has this wonderful family, and he's living his life, and it's revealed that he has a mistress. It's a woman that he met who was a flight attendant. He met her on an airplane. And he was flying to somewhere, and she happened to be getting on. They end up together, and they have this long relationship. And he tells her, one day we'll be together. But he has no intent of leaving his wife and his kids. And finally, one day, she confronts him, and she gets hysterical. And the next thing you know, she's trying to contact his wife to tell him this is what's going on. And he's beside himself. He doesn't know what to do. Now, there's another plot going on over here with Woody Allen and his marriage breaking up. And they run along beside each other. And at the end, the two guys come together, the doctor and Woody Allen. But the doctor doesn't know what to do. As it turns out, he has a brother that's in the underworld. His name is Jack. And he says, Jack, what do I do? And Jack, the guy that plays Jack, you can just tell, he's a thug. I mean, he'll hurt you. He said, Jack, what should I do? Well, we could have her killed. We could knock her off. And he says, you are crazy. What are you talking about? And over time, the idea of having her kid's conscience begins to wane. And finally, as she gets more and more hysterical, he says, okay, let's do it. And she's killed. She knocked the other shot in her apartment. And he's never caught. After he's killed for a period of time, his wife thinks he's losing his mind. And then you fast forward several months, and his daughter's getting married. And at the end of the movie, the doctor and Woody Allen are sitting in the bar, and this big wedding celebration is going on. And he says this, the The doctor says this, if you think about the big questions, if you think about what life means, there are no answers. And the movie closes, he says, since there is no meaning in life, he says, all you can do is enjoy the pleasures of the day. And the movie ends. And that's what our world's doing. That's what our world's doing. Is that life under the sun, life devoid of God, makes no sense. And therefore, you pour yourself in either pleasure, you pour yourself, all the things that Solomon poured himself into work and labor, into gaining knowledge. But he says in the end, it's all meaningless. That's what Woody Allen has concluded. That's what modern man has concluded with life under the sun. Comments, real quick.
It seems like it takes a little bit of burden off of us, modern day guys, if you can look at a guy like this that absolutely had everything and what he discovered. Kind of just, you can step back, if you can apply it to your own life, you don't have to chase all that stuff.
Yeah, that's when God enters the picture, everything changes. And you know what? It struck me. This is kind of what we've just been talking about. It's kind of, there's nothing real uplifting about it. But it's true. And so this is the question we want to, I want to close with, and we'll be looking at it in the weeks to come. Is to consider this issue of meaning. Which is basically what this book is about. Because he's saying everything is meaningless. But man seems to be searching for meaning. Why is that? Dallas Willard, I want to read you. This is really powerful, guys. He is just he's one of the smartest guys that I've ever read. Some of his books are really difficult to read. But in my opinion, his best book is called Renovation of the Heart. And in it, he writes, you know, he was a philosophy professor taught at USC. In fact, he was head of the philosophy department there for a number of years, so he's obviously very highly regarded. He said, finding meaning, he died 2 years ago. He said, finding meaning is a real problem for modern people. He says, and yet, meaning is one of the greatest needs of human life. It's one of our deepest hungers. He says, perhaps it is, in the final analysis, the most basic need in the realm of human experience. And he says, you can bear almost anything if your life as a whole is meaningful. And as I was preparing this, I don't know if you remember, and I promise you, we're going to end this session on a more encouraging note. But as I was preparing this, I was reminded of something in the book, The True Measure of a Man. I'm going to read just a couple of paragraphs and then talk about, you know, what is God's intent and where is meaning really found. Imagine the horror of a Nazi concentration camp in Hungary. This is a true story. Imagine that we are Jews held against our will and forced to work in a factory that supplies the Nazis' growing war machine. We're just barely surviving. And then one day an Allied aircraft blasts the area and destroys the hated factory. The next morning several hundred of us are herded to one end of the charred remains. Expecting orders to begin rebuilding, we are puzzled when the Nazi officer commands us to shovel sand into carts and haul it to the other end of the plant. The next day, the process is repeated in reverse. We are now ordered to move a huge pile of sand back to the other end of the compound. A mistake must have been made, we say to ourselves. These stupid swine. But a guard soon shouts and we pick up our pace. Then day after day, we're forced to haul the same pile of sand from one end of the camp to the other. Finally, one old man begins to cry uncontrollably, and the guard hauls him away. Another screams until he's beaten into silence. Then a young man who has survived 3 years in the camp darts away from the group. The guards shout for him to stop as he makes a run for the electrified fence. We all cry out, but it's too late. There's a blinding flash and a terrible sizzling noise as smoke rises from the smoldering flesh. In the days that followed, dozens of other prisoners go mad and run from their work, only to be shot by the guards or electrocuted by the fence. We overhear the commandant, Raleigh, remark that soon there won't be any more need for the crematory. I paraphrase the telling of the above story as it originally appeared in Charles Colson's book, Kingdoms in Conflict, to emphasize the point Colson made. Life seems purposeless. If life seems purposeless over time, we will become dysfunctional. Our minds will snap. If no meaning or purpose is behind the events as they unfold, life will always be bleak and hopeless, just like Solomon is described. And then the question is asked, would it have made a difference if the Nazis had forced the prisoners to do the exact same work, but instead the purpose of the labor was to assist in building an orphanage for the Hungarian children who lost their parents in the war? This shift in perspective underscores the concept Colson believes is so critically important to grasp, finding meaning and purpose behind what we are experiencing in life is everything. And so Solomon is telling us that despair and meaninglessness is what we face if there is no God. And that's what you see in the first chapter, verses 2 through 3. Meaninglessness, meaninglessness, says the teacher. Utter meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What does man gain from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? And so I want to end our time together in the next few minutes and ask the question, what do you think, therefore, it means to have a meaningful life? And why does God play such an essential role? Any thoughts or ideas on that? What does it mean to have a meaningful life, and why does God play such an essential role? Yeah, I would say two things, and then we'll, in the last session that we do on this, we're going to talk about, how do you really find true meaning in life? But I think the clues are here. We just talked about it. But think about, it should have a huge impact on your life if you realize that your life and my life is of great value in the sight of God. That we have tremendous value because we're designed in His image. And so we have great value. And then we're told, remember, and this is a key, I think, Ephesians 2:10, you remember what it says? We are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which He prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. And you remember what that word workmanship means? It's the Greek word poema, P-O-I-M-A, P-O-I-A-M-A, P-O-I-M-A, poema. And that is the Greek word for work of art. We are God's work of art. We are created uniquely. Every man in this room has their certain unique gifts and abilities. And it says, we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for certain good works. There are certain things that God wants to do in and through each of our lives. And He prepared these before we were even born. And so I think that is a key element of this. But also what Gary just mentioned, that, that we have purpose and meaning when we do what we're designed to do. And that is to know God and to live in a relationship with Him. Remember, that is the logos, which the Greeks were searching for, the reason for life. The problem, if you recall, they never could figure it out. They never could agree on it. And then John really drops a bombshell when he says, in the beginning was the Logos, the reason for life. As Charlie says, the reason for life is a person, Jesus. And so we are called to live our lives in relationship with Him. That's the beginning of where meaning is found. And living with Him and walking with Him through life and allowing Him to lead and guide us into the plans that He has. we're out of time, but there's a verse that's in Luke chapter 7, verse 30. It talks about the scribes and the Pharisees. It says, they rejected God's purpose for themselves. Exactly what it says. Look it up. Luke 7:30. The scribes and the Pharisees rejected God's purpose for their lives because they refused to be baptized by John. Now, what does that mean? Refused? What was John's message? John's message was repentance for the forgiveness of sins, so that when your sins are forgiven, you can enter into a relationship with God. That's the purpose that they rejected. They rejected the message, the good news that you see in the New Testament. And unfortunately, that's what so many people do today. They reject God's purpose for their lives. They reject Him. They live without Him. And over time, they begin to realize everything's meaningless. And that's why there is so much despair and there's so much depression in our culture. And Seligman, I think, puts his finger on it. We don't live for a higher cause. We don't live for Him. And remember, we exist for Him. That's why we're here.